Welcome, everyone, to our program. Today we're going to meet an open access hero, and we'll tell you just why she deserves that accolade in just a moment. Tell you, too, that we are very happy to have you join us for this program, part of a continuing series of webinars around open access the Copyright Clearance Center has presented for the last several years now. And we welcome people from across North America and Europe, managing editors and production directors, ERP product managers, and OA specialists from institutions and funders. You are all very welcome indeed to our program. It's important to note that Outsell estimates that open access accounted for only 1.1% of the total STM market in 2014. That's the latest number available. Nevertheless, OA revenues are growing much faster than subscriptions. Meanwhile, funders and institutions are taking the lead to place authors at the center of the business model, with mandates for publishers and even competitive publishing initiatives pushing them further. Taking on the publishing challenge of open access are real heroes like Ray de Guzman of BMJ Group in London. The path to success that she has enjoyed and BMJ has enjoyed has relied on a robust infrastructure that automates and innovates from end to end: author submissions, editorial review, and financial reports. And on our webinar today, Ray de Guzman will tell us about that journey she's undertaken with her colleagues, how they've managed to streamline APC collections and contain OA-related costs. So we will hear all about that. Some of the specifics for the BMJ case are really quite interesting, and we think that you who are also facing these challenges and sharing these problems will find them enlightening. So again, welcome indeed to our program. And by way of further background, as we recently learned, Copyright Clearance Center hosted a town hall at the Frankfurt Book Fair just last month. And we had a chance to meet and interview Vitek Tross, who is the nearly legendary founder of Biomed Central, which he first launched in 1999. And it's important to remember that that wasn't so very long ago. And at that time, Biomed Central was a startup with a risky business model based on author fees rather than subscription, something we take for granted today, but was, again, very much on the cutting edge in 1999. Now, today, in 2016, author fees are an established part of the publishing landscape. The open access revolution has created a dramatically new kind of customer relationship for publishers with their authors. And as the transition to OA advances, innovations continue to come, and sometimes from unexpected sources. What these initiatives have in common is a willingness to challenge the status quo. And we have a full report available on all of this, an article by Rob Johnson, who has been featured in some of our webinars in the past, that was published in tandem with the Frankfurt Book Fair in October at the bookseller, and we'll be giving you a link to that article later on. But Rob asked some important questions, in particular how publishers are responding to the developments that open access is driving. And they are doing so first, as we've alluded to, by streamlining services provided to authors. And secondly, and this is important, they are recognizing that their own expertise in publishing remains indispensable. And regardless of business models, they have responsibilities as publishers that they need to take up and be successful at. So all that is background for the main event here. I want to welcome from London, Ray de Guzman at the BMJ. Ray, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you, Chris. And a warm welcome to everybody. I hope you can hear me okay. Again, can you hear me okay?
Indeed we do. You sound loud and clear.
Excellent. A big thank you to CCC, all of you guys. I'm very flattered to have been invited to speak at this event, and I hope I prove worthy of such a grand title.
I have no doubt at all. And listen, we'll tell people briefly about your background and about BMJ. Now, you've been there at BMJ for the last 7 years, started, as many do in publishing, as an editorial assistant before taking on more technical and operational support roles. And this has all happened in what can only be described as a period of transition for BMJ. And BMJ, of course, is internationally renowned. It's a leading peer-reviewed medical journal with an archive back to 1840. And I think it's striking to make note, Ray, that In May 1995, the BMJ became the first online general medical journal. And you celebrated 20 years online just last year in 2015. And I think that's an indication of the forward thinking that happens at BMJ. As much as it's really an institution for nearly two centuries now, it's very much one with its feet planted firmly in the digital environment. And although you are speaking to us today from London, it, again, is very much an international brand with editors and offices throughout the world, including in North America, Asia, China, and Australia. And Ray, you want to tell us a bit more about BMJ, in particular the open access journals that you publish.
Yes. So what we have here is a quick snapshot of the BMJ journals portfolio. So we have 63 specialist journals, both in print and some are online only, and now 14 pure OA titles as well. So we've got BMJ Open featured here, which was launched in 2010 and now has an impact factor of 2.56, which is excellent to see. So the BMJ are managing around 42,500 submissions a year and averaging about 10,000 accepted articles. And those numbers are all growing, especially as we are seeing a big growth in open access research being submitted and published. And since we've been collecting article processing charges since 2005, so BMJ has really been in the open access game for quite a while now, starting off with the hybrid option, allowing authors to opt into open access. And as we're seeing the landscape change, we've seen how we've had to adapt and grow our business and be able to cater to the demand of funders and the increase of submissions for all of these different areas.
Right.
So that's a little bit about the BMJ.
Right. And what's, I think, important about that is it the graph of BMJ's growth in the open access environment really kind of maps to the publishing world at large. I think if you go back to 2005, open access was there. It was a presence, but it was yet to be a significant part of the business. And I imagine a lot of people only a decade ago never really thought it would take off in quite the way it did. But BMJ kind of adapted as things changed, and I think that's a remarkable story, and again, one that everyone joining us today probably finds very familiar in their own environment. And this has been, not easy to do because open access, Ray, is very much an evolving model for everyone, and it has been evolving for BMJ particularly.
Yes, precisely. So what you're seeing here is we've got a timeline of the evolution of BMJ's systems, so to speak, to manage our open access program. And you can see how this timeline corresponds to various movements within the industry relating to the various mandates and funder requirements. And initially, as you say, the uptake was small. Manual invoicing was really the way we were processing things in 2005. We're looking at, receiving a request to make something open access and sending an email down to finance, creating a paper invoice, which then gets faxed over to an author or to an institution. And, it was taking maybe up to 2 months for those payments to come in. But as open access started to grow alongside our acquisition of different titles, we were also in a position to transition to a new submission system, which had a PayPal integration. So for the first time in 2011, we were able to collect our APC. So this is both open access and color charges, color image charges, by credit card, which was fantastic, allowing the authors to pay immediately upon acceptance. However, we were still needing to do manual invoicing at that stage. And really, as the demand started to grow, we had to find ways of being able to keep up with that demand. And we were already working with the CCC, the permission system to collect payments for rights and licensing. And so in 2013, we started to look at RightsLink as a solution for managing the manual invoice aspect of collecting those fees. And this worked extremely well for us.
Well, right, Ray, if I can just say it. So people are familiar with RightsLink because it's not a new product entirely. And, at BMJ, you were using RightsLink at that point, and we'll learn how this evolved, but for permissions. And so what you had under the hood, so to speak, there was an e-commerce engine that you began to leverage. But you wanted to tell us about first the PayPal integration. So RightsLink is there in the background, but you all at BMJ chose to go with PayPal because it would allow you to process these invoices using credit card. But there was a hitch there as well.
Yeah, so I think during this time of transition, what the BMJ really tried to focus on is the interoperability between all of the systems. And so looking at making sure that all of these different elements are as integrated as possible was really important to us. So this is how we ended up adopting PayPal through our submission system. It allowed for credit card payments, but it was still lacking in the manual invoicing side. So this is how we began to look towards RightsLink as a solution, because it was able to look after both credit card payments and invoicing, as well as enhanced reporting requirements. So that really helped there.
Indeed, and so you began to use RightsLink as the engine for those transactions in 2013, and that was important to us here at Copyright Clearance Center because it was right around then, as we mentioned, if you go back 2005, open access was sort of there in the background and nobody really noticed it very much. But by 2013, the volume had turned up considerably. We had mandates from Welcome. We had mandates from various government agencies in the UK and the US, and really further pressure from authors to, as you've already alluded to, deliver the kind of service levels that they expected from other parts of their online experience. And so it was in a sort of a two-way communication that we first moved you into handling APCs with RightsLink, and then that then led to the debut of the RightsLink platform for open access in 2015, that important communication with everyone there at BMJ.
Yes, and one of the biggest responses that BMJ had towards the open access mandates was the open access program, whereby BMJ offers institutions, universities, and funders either the option to have a prepay account with a BMJ or a membership account, which grants affiliated authors with discounts to the open access fee. This new business model, so to speak, meant that the types of transactions that we're seeing are now far more complex than, you know, requesting for open access and making a payment for that. What we're looking at is now needing to verify and identify authors from specific affiliations and to consider different funder requirements and being able to cater to those and make sure that authors can remain compliant. And also, this new service to institutions meant that we were now looking at providing much more in-depth and detailed reporting of usage of such prepay and membership accounts, because institutions and funders are definitely taking more of an interest in seeing where the open access research funds are being used. And this is where RightsLink for Open Access was able to really go forward with that, because we're then able to look after and manage a lot of those more complex relationships between each of our institutions.
Right, a very important point. And Ray, you're alluding there to something that it looks on my screen might be cut off, but the point here is that as OA grew, so did BMJ's challenges and the kind of requirements that funders were expecting, that institutions were expecting to be fulfilled, that authors were expecting, really meant a need for metadata, for the identifiers that you mentioned. Tell us a bit more about that. As things began to scale, how did things get more complex?
So as mentioned, we are now needing to identify the authors before processing their transaction to make sure that they obtain the right fees, the right licensing information, and published with their article. And so what this meant for us is that we really have to look towards industry standards such as ORCID and Ringgold, as well as FundRef. So we're taking advantage of these initiatives, which are ultimately key identifiers for these researchers, and then making sure, as I mentioned earlier, that the interoperability between these different initiatives, these different systems, are all kind of sewn together seamlessly. This means taking advantage of, API web services. So there's a real technical challenge that was there for us in making sure that all of these different elements tie together, but still appear to be seamless to the authors. So, we're looking at the user interface for the authors should be as simple and as straightforward as possible. So those are the kinds of things that we had to deal with when we're talking about, scalability.
Right, and there's a holistic approach to all of this. I mean, on the one hand, BMJ has got responsibilities around collection and reporting, but those kind of sort of measuring points aren't the only ones. I mean, you've got relationships with the authors, relationships with their societies, the memberships you spoke about. This is a world that is, it's about open access, but it's about so much more than that, it seems.
Yes, definitely. I think it's interesting to see the developments in the relationships between us as a publisher and our authors and institutions and the different funders and meeting all of their requirements. I mean, one of the things that I found interesting is dealing with the reporting requests that we receive from various institutions. From turnaround times of payment turnaround times to geographical breakdowns of where the research is coming from, and just being able to slice that information in all of the different ways that institutions are interested in seeing that information, it's a service that we are providing to our authors and institutions, and it's also interesting to see, from their perspective, what they are interested in looking at.
Right, and in fact, we can even get a look at what that looks like to the author, because you've shared with us here a kind of a sample of what you're calling the author payment journey. Tell us what we see here.
Yeah, so this is just a quick shot of what the author sees when they are invited to make payments for their article. So essentially, what happens is they receive a link which gives them access to this interface. And we worked really hard with CCC to make sure that we have the journal branding, any society branding, and make it clear the amount that the author is due to pay, as well as providing them with links and information and any access to any resource to make sure that they understand exactly what this process is, and what they are committing to when they're making this payment. And it's if you could see all of the different faces this view has had over the part, since 2005, it's changed tremendously. And to see this now here with RightsLink, it's so much more cleaner. It's a lot more user-friendly for the author. And it was interesting to see in the recent Welcome Research, the Welcome Studies survey about open access. You know, authors really still do, they care about open access, but they still prefer, well, they still consider journal reputation over open access, you know, i.e. they just want to get published. They don't want to have to deal with processing transactions and whether they're compliant. You know, they want to make sure that all those things are in place, but, you know, they just want to get it over and done with and be published. And so it's really important to us that we help authors reach that point and make sure it's as easy as possible for them.
Well, that's a great reminder, Ray, because as you say, authors care about these things, but they really care about their research and they care about their publications. And what they care about when it comes to what you're calling the author payment journey here is getting it done. And that's really what BMJ has focused on. And when it comes to getting done, or getting open access done, there's quite a lot to get done here for BMJ. And this slide is kind of neat as a way of thinking about the various steps in the process that start with kind of not only, you know, the acceptance of a manuscript, but the metadata that needs to be collected to enable all the steps further down the line.
Yeah, so, I mean, this is a real contrast to the previous slide, because what I've tried to highlight here are all of the multiple steps that, you know, us as a publisher has to kind of manage in order to get that author payment journey as easy as a single screen for them. But behind the scenes, you know, we have to make sure that all of the metadata is collected up front and that we're collecting the right information. You know, and then after the peer review process and being accepted, we're making sure that that's a seamless interaction between our submission systems and Rights Link, and then finally through to once the payment's being made, making sure that the production system receives all of the correct information to automate the correct license being published with the article. So there's all of that happening in the background, and the author is none wiser, which is good for them. And really, also what I wanted to highlight here on this page is we're looking at volumes of papers that are being published as open access. So we can see that via the prepay model, we've got over 600 articles and over 600 again being published under the membership discount model. And so far year to date, since moving to WritesLink for open access, we've published over 4,000 open access articles. And I think this time last year, it was actually at 1,500. So we can see the growth that there has been in publishing open access titles. And one of the things that we were interested in seeing at the BMJ as well is not just being able to manage the volume and the quantity, but also looking at how long authors are having to spend interacting with a system. And we're pleased to say that we've reduced the average number of days to pay by card from 3 to 5 days down to zero. So authors are completing that transaction almost immediately. And we're looking at 22 days on average to pay via bank transfer, so that's by invoice. So there's still maybe some improvement that can be done there, but that is a significant reduction in time when that used to be up to 60 days sometimes. But it's definitely getting there, I think.
Right. Well, what we're seeing is some important numbers going up, the ones you do care about and that the authors care about, which is the articles getting published, and then some other important numbers that on the business side you care about. Those are going down, and you updated this slide for us, and we're not just talking about a couple of minutes, a couple of hours. As you mentioned, when it came to bank transfers, back in the day, that sometimes could take 6 weeks. So really, these are significant significant movements. And as that thoughtful figure in the center of the screen is asking about what we can do to improve, and I guess you really see an opportunity still to work on all of this.
Yes, I think, you know, we've had some, you know, speaking with some of the institutions, and if we take the example of payment via bank transfer or invoices. You know, on the institution side, you know, they're still dealing with paper invoices, and when it's submitted, the author has to get it signed by various departments, or it has to be passed through for various people to approve. And most things do take time, and we understand that as well. And it's good for us to know and understand how our institutions and how our authors are dealing with these payments, so that we can see if there are any ways that we can make that easier for them. And you know, that question is there to the audience as well, to see, you know, what things they think can be improved, or how they can be improved, if they have any solutions to problems that they see. It's always great to hear from others.
Indeed. And Ray, we'll let you take a moment there. And while we speak to my colleague, Chuck Hemingway, who's with me here at Copyright Clearance Center. Chuck, welcome to the webinar.
Always a pleasure.
Well, we're happy to have you join us because you've worked with Ray over the development of the open access solution with RightsLink for BMJ, but you see the picture a little more broadly because you speak to a number of publishers. And what we have been doing, as I alluded to earlier on at Copyright Clearance Center, is really listening as hard as we can because this is something where everyone is sort of, if not flying blind, at least learning as they go along. And there have been some significant insights that we've gathered from the publishers we work with around what are the elements of a successful solution.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. We've been getting a lot of feedback from publishers themselves and, of course, the other stakeholders in the market, institutions, funders, authors, everybody who has a horse in this race. And what we're finding out is that there are going to be some clear winners and clear losers in this segment of the market. Many publishers that have been involved with open access in the early going, like BMJ, have, by nature of just simply trying to provide a better level of service to their authors and their institutions, have come up with organic market advantage. Because they now have tools to be nimble and scale quickly. They can provide the institutions and the authors with the types of services that they need. And as Jay said, Ray said, there's more work to be done, and we're talking about the next iteration. And they've also, I think, by doing these things, by creating extensions for the author, extensions out to the institutions and funders, they've leveraged an incredible power of attraction. You know, this is the kind of publisher that societies want to work with when they're ready to, you know, hand over their program to another party. And BMJ, I'd have to mention this, they've been a tremendous partner. Ray and her team have had great influence on how this solution works. Their fingerprints are all over it, and it's that much the better for it.
Right. Right. Well, indeed, it is a great story. We have a case study on it here at Copyright Clearance Center that people can get on our website, or perhaps we'll send a link along in the follow-up to the program today. It's important because it goes into detail on all of this, but I'm fascinated by really the dynamic nature of all of this. It has been something, and Ray went into this going back to the early days in 2005, but it's still happening today. You know, people are adapting to the changes. They are seeing the way ahead and really being open to these new models and to these new ways of doing business, and all to the point, as you say, of attracting and retaining the authors. That's the critical piece.
Absolutely. And I think for the first time in a long time, this particular vexing problem in the market, you know, when OA grew quickly and continues to grow, it creates some real challenges. And to the credit of all the stakeholders, there's been a lot of collaboration. Many funders have willingly come to the table to discuss with publishers and institutions. You know, we work closely with funders, RLUK, institutions, and others to really map out practical solutions to real problems. So without that cooperation, I don't think we would have had the level of success that we're having.
And what's interesting is, and again, we talked about this with Ray DeGuzman, that open access is important and it really gets a lot of attention. But publishing goes on pretty much as it has for the last three centuries. And outfits like BMJ are looking at not just the open access challenge, but the continuing challenge of being successful operations. And once you solve that problem, and not an easy one, of handling APCs, there's opportunity within that.
Absolutely. And I think it points to a bit of a shift in publishing to where publishing isn't so much about the journal product and about editions and volumes. It's about services. The more successful ones are morphing into service providers. So to provide the right kinds of services to authors, institutions, funders, whoever their constituents may be, has been absolutely critical. And that's been a big part of our philosophy for the future, not only with this solution but with other solutions, is creating frameworks which will allow publishers to offer more services, to offer higher levels of engagement throughout any one of these contact points, of which the author payment process is simply one of those contact points.
All right. Well, Chuck Hemingway, thanks for that background on it. And we want to turn now to you and our audience, so we'll bring back Ray DeGuzman from BMJ and ask you to raise your hands, let us know what's on your mind. And as people are thinking about what to ask, Chuck, I want to ask you about sort of the forward thinking that we're doing. You mentioned the various stakeholders here, and that is one of the interesting elements of open access, is that it has thrown light into corners of the publishing world that were previously, if not in the shadows, at least not so well known. So we see a kind of a spectrum of authors, publishers, institutions, where they are a faculty or as a researcher, and then the funders themselves. And so these institutions, as much as the authors have expectations, the institutions and the funders too have them as well. And what are some of the things that they have started to look for?
Specifically, they started to ask for things like aggregated billing. I think Ray called it out as one of her examples. Processing an individual invoice takes time, and I think there have been some studies that say maybe £65 per invoice to process those at the institution level. So we've been hearing from funders and institutions on simple things like aggregated invoicing. Can we have one invoice with seven items rather than seven invoices? Another would be reporting. Those stakeholders want to come in and get data for themselves. They don't want to have to rely on the publisher to give them reports. They want to be able to come in and take them, as needed across our whole stable of publishers. So those are things that are very much under consideration.
Yeah, and Ray DeGuzman, I suppose that rings true for you. The aggregation of billing, the efficiency here of the approach is what's critical, but that reporting piece can't be underestimated either.
Yes, I mean, having a kind of institutional portal, so to speak, allowing the institution to be able to access the payment system would be a great advantage, because we're looking at reducing the time, the administrative time spent paying multiple invoices, as well as our time spent putting together reports for institutions, if they can go in and take a look at their own kind of reports across multiple publishers would be a massive benefit to the institutions.
Right, and the relationships that the authors have, their important relationship with BMJ is obviously with their editors, but they have other relationships that they bring to the table, and as faculty members, as employees of one institution or another, that's important to you at BMJ. So you've briefly mentioned some of the ways that this is an opportunity to help to offer discounts, special services. Tell us a bit more about that.
Yes, I mean, we want to be able to make sure that as many of our authors can publish open access where they need to or where they want to. And what's interesting is we're seeing, open access is a massive benefit to a lot of the researchers in lower middle income countries. And so, you know, being able to allow authors to make part payments on the open access where the funding, so what we're finding is authors are, the funding will pay for one part of the transaction, and then the authors are usually paying the rest of the transaction out of another fund or their own pocket sometimes. And so having that functionality to be able to service that helps our authors to get published.
Right.
That's really important to us.
Right. Well, Ray, we have a question here from Kirsty, which is about how early in the process you can notify authors about the APC charges and then the licensing info. Actually, I guess it's really notifying institutions. And so there's timing issues here that Kirsty is getting at. You know them better than I. So can you tell us what the timing is?
So we don't currently send this information ahead of article acceptance, usually because it can take quite a while before we know that a manuscript is accepted. And so we do this only post acceptance. But it is interesting to hear, is there a growing demand for sending this information to institutions ahead of acceptance? I know for sure that institutions are requesting deposits of the pre-accepted version of an article, but we've not yet had many requests for receiving the license information before acceptance.
Yeah. So Chuck, we're telling people you're out there listening what people have to say. This is a great question, and Ray, thank you for raising it to the open audience here. Which is there a growing demand for this kind of thing?
There is, I think it has less to do with the acceptance of the article than it has to do with the approval of funds being released. So one of the major themes in our discussions with universities and institutions has been they are asking to be part of this information cycle so that when authors are nearing acceptance that they get some warning. You know, you have a faculty member in the queue, they're going to be accepted. They're going to use these funds, we've been working closely with those institutions to develop mediated workflows where an author will basically go through a short approval process and the institution will approve them, assign a dollar value of approved spending, and all of that entails. So it's a very hot question right now.
All right. Well, thank you for that. We have another question here for Ray from Charles, and let's see. It says, did you estimate a threshold number of OA articles which made the outsource to CCC worthwhile? And it's a fair question to ask. I mean, this is a business decision. You clearly have showed us how quickly the ramp up time has been on submissions. But was it something you expected? Has the growth in this been so much faster than you anticipated, or are you seeing things pretty much as predicted?
It is definitely a lot faster than we anticipated. I'll have to get back to you in terms of an actual estimated threshold number, because I'm sure we can find that out. But as mentioned earlier, you know, this time last year, since moving on to WriteSpeak for Open Access, we were publishing over 1,500 open access articles, and this time, like now, year to date, it's up to 4,000. So we can see that it's more than doubled in just a year, which is definitely an interesting, growth that we're seeing, that we're experiencing.
Well, interesting is putting it mildly. You might call it explosive, frankly. But,
yes, definitely.
You take it all in stride there at BMJ. Anyway, thank you for that question, Charles. And I think that about closes things out here. We want to sort of draw to people's attention some things that you can access to learn more about open access. And Copyright Clearance Center has been providing a lot of information and resources on this topic now for a number of years. Importantly, we have another webinar in the series coming up on December 15th. We're going to look at the implications and the issues regarding the new welcome guidelines for publishers. Welcome, formerly known as Welcome Trust, has been a frequent guest in our series. They will be back with us to explain what the guidelines are about and why publishers really need to understand them fully. We'll have Hannah Hope from Wellcome joining us. And for background and kind of bird's eye view of these the implications for that, joining us will be Liz Ferguson from Wiley, who runs their open access program there, as well as David Prosser from RL UK, an important, indeed, a leading UK funder. You want to learn a little bit more about what other publishers and observers of the scene of open access are thinking about OA, and in particular, its potential as an entrepreneurial offering. We conducted a panel at the Frankfurt Book Fair, our annual town hall. You can access an audio podcast of that town hall discussion featuring VTech Tross, Brandon Nordine from the American Chemical Society, Kate Warlock from Outsell, and others. That's on our CCC podcast website at beyondthebook.com. I mentioned earlier an article by Rob Johnson called Open for Business, looking at, again, the business repercussions of the open access environment, an article Rob published in the bookseller. We'll get you the link to that in our follow-up emails. And as always, all of the information we work together with ALPSP in the UK to build out something we call the Open Access Resource Center, and that's online at openaccessresources.org. So all of that available to you, and I want to take a moment right now to thank you all for joining us, for being with us for the last 45 minutes or so. Ray de Guzman there at BMJ in London, really appreciate your contribution. You've been our hero today, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And Chuck Hemingway, thank you.
Always a pleasure.
And on behalf of everyone at Cartwright Clarence Center, particularly Casey Bassett, who's kept the webinar online here, this is Chris Keneally. Have a great day.